Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 19, Silence, Solitude, and Simplicity. Ken Wilber offers a helpful distinction between stages and states. Your stage of human development has to do with your location in time, your culture, and your education. It has to do with your level of intellectual maturity, how much you've been able to integrate thought patterns in a consistent and informed way. Most of us in our lifetimes have grown through a few stages. Eventually, we see the limits of each of the previous stages. We see that both in our own lives and within history. But those stages move on to the next. In general, the idea tangent is pre-rational through rational and on to transrational thought. The transrational stage builds on the other two and thus has endless horizons. This is the full trajectory and direction of human growth, and it has many intermediate stops and starts in between. Your state of consciousness is more about your level of inner awakening than mere correct information. How much do you live connected to self and others and the whole? How much you overcome your sense of separateness and superiority? How much do body, soul, and spirit work together as one? How much do body, soul, and spirit coalesce? And have you moved beyond simply reacting? And can you act and think in pure inner freedom? In traditional religious language, how much do you live in union with God? Your state is your inner aliveness. Your stage is your outer awareness. The goal is to be both holy, H-O-L-Y, and whole, W-H-O-L-E. Saintly and wise. But your state and your stage don't always coincide. Many of us are stronger in one area than the other. You can be a high-level thinker and be quite astute about psychology, theology, history, or philosophy. That would be a high stage. But you do it all from a perspective of individualism and arrogance about that very information. That's a low state, because it's still about you. Conversely, you could be quite unified within and with others in a high state of loving consciousness, but be poorly informed, lacking in exposure and education. Perhaps you know people who are compassionate and kind, yet still reveal prejudicial attitudes. They may seem hypocritical, but simply at a high state and a low stage. Love will win out in them, and goodness will flow through them, even if they don't have the gift of teaching or of understanding complex and contrary issues. They are holy, but not whole, saintly, but not smart, or would make, as Teresa of Avila said, the kind of spiritual directors that are not helpful. And this describes many of the desert fathers and mothers. high states of union, but low levels of cultural, historical, or intellectual exposure to coherent thinking. Enjoy them for their state, but do not hate them for their stage. Today, we have large segments of the population with the opposite problem: high stages of intellectual exposure with very low levels of unitive consciousness. Very smart, but without awe, humility, or love, which the desert fathers and mothers have in spades. And many of the desert sayings may sound naive, simplistic, and even dangerous. They are highly open to misinterpretation. Try to receive the simple wisdom of the desert mystics with an open heart and mind, and let it lead you to authentic joy. Perceive and enjoy their state of loving union, but don't hate them for living in a pre-rational Egypt and Syria. This will help you understand many people in our own time as well. The desert tradition offers a rich teaching of surrender through contemplation to the wonderful and always too much mystery of God. The desert fathers and mothers are like the Zen Buddhist monks of Christianity. Their sayings are often like koans that cannot be understood with the rational, logical mind. The desert mystics focused much more on the how than the what. Note that this is very different from the primary emphasis of Christianity in recent centuries: the what of beliefs and doctrine. Thomas Merton observed that the Western Church had largely neglected the teachings of contemplation for at least the last 500 years. He helped modern Christianity recover an awareness of contemplative practice, in part from his readings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. They were surely bona fide Christians, and yet knew none of the doctrines which many of us today take as essential orthodoxy, such as the two natures of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity, the inerrancy of the Bible, and on and on. This early period is a clearinghouse for essential Christianity. The desert mystic's primary quest for God, for love, the desert mystic's primary quest was for God, for love. Everything else was secondary. Thomas Merton writes, "All through the Verba Signorum, we find a repeated instance on the primacy of love over everything else in the spiritual life, over knowledge, over gnosis, over asceticism, over contemplation, over solitude, and even over prayer. Love, in fact, is the spiritual life, and without it, all the other exercises of the spirit, however lofty, are emptied of content and become mere illusions. The more lofty they are, the more dangerous the illusion." The Desert Fathers and Mothers focused on these primary practices in their search for God, first, leaving, to some extent, the systems of the world; second, some degree of solitude to break from the maddening crowd; third, silence to break from the maddening mind; and fourth, some technologies for controlling the compulsivity of mind and the emotions. All of this was for the sake of growing a person capable of love and community. Contemplation became a solid foundation for building a civilization and human community. Contemplative consciousness labels things less easily and does not attach itself to one solitary definitive meaning. In contemplation, one experiences all things as somehow created in the image of God and therefore of equal dignity and deserving of respect. Let us take this moment to practice silence, solitude, and simplicity. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The desert fathers and mothers withdrew from cities to the desert to live freely, apart from the economic, cultural, and political structure that Roman Empire that first persecuted the church and then later gave it a privileged status. In the empire's own search for uniformity and control. The desert fathers and mothers knew, as we should, that the empire would be an unreliable partner. They recognized that they had to find inner freedom from the system before they could return to it with true love, wisdom, and helpfulness. This is the continuing dynamic to this day. Otherwise, as Peter Drucker puts it, culture eats Christianity for lunch, and our deep transformative power is largely lost. How do we find inner freedom? Notice that whenever we suffer pain, the mind is always quick to identify with the negative aspect of things and replay them over and over again, wounding us deeply. Almost all humans have obsessive-compulsive disorder of the mind, which is why so many people become fearful, hate-filled, and wrapped around their negative commentaries. This pattern must be recognized early and definitively. Peace of mind is actually an oxymoron. When you're in your mind, you're hardly ever at peace. And when you're at peace, you are never only in your mind. The early Christian Abbas, fathers, and Ammas, mothers, knew this and first insisted on finding the inner rest and quiet necessary to tame the obsessive mind. Their method was first called the prayer of quiet and eventually was referred to as contemplation. It is the core teaching in the early Christian period and emphasized much more in the Eastern Church than in the West. In a story from Benedicta Ward's The Saying of the Desert Fathers, a brother came to Sketus to visit Abba Moses and asked him for a word. The old man said to him, "Go, sit in your cell, and your cell will teach you everything." End quote. But you don't have to have a cell, and you don't have to run away from the responsibilities of an active life to experience solitude and silence. Amma Sinkletica said, "There are many who live in the mountains and behave as if they were in the town, and they are wasting their time. It is possible to be a solitary in one's mind while living in a crowd, and it is possible for one who is a solitary to live in the crowd of his own thoughts." End quote. By solitude, the desert mystics didn't mean mere privacy or protected space. Although there is a need for that too. The desert mystics saw solitude, in Henry Nouwen's words, as a place of conversion, the place where the old self dies and the new self is born, the place where the emergence of the new man and the new woman occurs. End quote. Solitude is a courageous encounter with our naked, most raw and real self in the presence of pure love. Quite often, this can happen right in the midst of human relationships and busy lives. Especially when outward distractions disappear, we find the greatest distraction from reality and from divine union is our own busy mind and selfish heart. Anthony the Great said, "The man who abides in solitude and is quiet is delivered from fighting three battles, those of hearing, speech, and sight. Then he will have but one battle to fight, the battle of the heart." End quote. In the same way as the early church, the desert Christians were deeply committed to Jesus' teachings and lived practice. Their chosen solitude and silence was not antisocial, but a way to become better at seeing clearly and at loving deeply. Withdrawal was done for the sake of deeper encounter and presence. Diana Butler Bass describes the natural flow from solitude to prayer to active love. She writes, "Jesus' invitation to come follow me was intimately bound up with the practice of prayer, for prayer connects us with God and others, part of this enterprise of learning to love. Prayer is much more than a technique, and early Christians left us no definitive how-to manual on prayer. Rather, the desert fathers and mothers believed that prayer was a disposition of wholeness, so that prayer and our life must be all of one piece. They approached prayer, as early church scholar Roberta Bondi notes, as a practical twofold process. First, of thinking and reflecting or pondering what it means to love others, and second, as the development and practice of loving ways of being. In other words, these ancients taught that prayer was participation in God's love, the activity that takes us out of ourselves, away from the familiar, and conforms us to the path of Christ." End quote. Through their solitude, the Abbas and Ammas learned to be sparing and intentional with their words and to preach more through their lifestyle than through sermons. There were few doctrines to prove at this time in Christianity, only an inner life to be experienced. Abba Isidore of Perugia said, "To live without speaking is better than to speak without living. For the former who lives rightly does good even by his silence, but the latter does no good even when he speaks. When words and life correspond to one another, they are together the whole of philosophy." End quote. An old Abba was asked what was necessary to be saved. He was sitting making rope. Without glancing up, he said, "You're looking at it." Just as so many of the mystics have taught us, doing what we're doing with care, presence, and intention is prayer, the very way to transformation and wholeness. As other master teachers have taught in many forms, when we walk, we walk. When we chop wood, we chop wood. When we sleep, we sleep. As you know, this is much harder than it first seems. Let us take this moment to practice silence, solitude, and simplicity. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The trouble and the opportunity in solitude is that there is no one around to blame for our moods and our difficulties. We are stuck with ourselves. Author Belden Lane helps clear away any romanticism we might associate with the desert spirituality. Belden writes, "The desert is preeminently a place to die. Anyone retreating to an Egyptian or Judean monastery, hoping to escape the tensions of city life, found little comfort among the likes of an Anthony or a Sabbas. The desert offered no private therapeutic place for solace and rejuvenation. One was most likely to be carried out feet first, than to be restored unchanged to the life one had left." End quote. In the tradition of Moses and Jesus, the Christians who wandered into the desert entered a wild, fierce, unknown place where they would encounter both demons and angels, Mark 1:13. In Belden Lane's words, Ama Syncletica refused to let anyone deceive herself by imagining that retreat to a desert monastery meant the guarantee of freedom from the world. The hardest world to leave, she knew, is the one within the heart. End quote. Another story from the Desert Fathers illustrates that even in the desert, there is no escaping one's own habitual responses. A brother was restless in the community and often moved to anger. So he said, I will go and live somewhere by myself. And since I shall be able to talk or listen to no one, I shall be tranquil and my passionate anger will cease. He went out and lived alone in a cave, but one day he filled his jug with water and put it on the ground. It happened suddenly to fall over. He filled it again and it fell again. And this happened a third time. And in a rage, he snatched up the jug and broke it. Returning to his right mind, he knew that the demon of anger had mocked him. And he said, Here am I by myself, and he has beaten me. I will return to the community. Wherever you live, you need effort and patience, and above all, God's help. And he rose up and went back. End quote. Belden Lane goes on to write, The desert monks were hardly naive despisers of culture. What they fled with greatest fear was not the external world, but the world they carried inside themselves. An ego-centeredness needing constant approval, driven by compulsive behavior, frantic in its effort to attend to a self-image that's always requiring mending. End quote. Ironically, in the fleeing, they ran smack dab into the very thing they sought to avoid. We have met the enemy, and he is us. Abba Poman asked at every moment, Who am I, and who are you? St. Francis would also spend whole nights praying this prayer. Baron von Hugel, in his classic study of mysticism, said that this might just be the perfect prayer. It is through encountering the absolute safety of God that we discover our true self, and in finding our truest self, we find a God who is always and forever larger than we expected. The truth of our identity, wrapped in God, gives us a deep sense of radical okayness, and yet humility about our fragility. What a paradox. Let me share with you three other sayings from the Desert Fathers and Mothers. Listen to these sayings and let them stir deeper questions and reflections. This is the power of these simple stories. 1. One day, Abba Arsenius consulted an old Egyptian monk about his own thoughts. Someone noticed this and said to him, Abba Arsenius, what is it that you, with such a good Latin and Greek education, ask this peasant about your thoughts? He replied, I have indeed been taught Latin and Greek, but I do not know even the alphabet of this peasant. Second saying, Abba Anthony said, A time is coming when men will go mad, and when they see someone who is not mad, they will attack him, saying, You are mad. You are not like us. Third saying, Abba Isaiah, whenever someone asked him what avarice was, he would reply, Not to believe that God cares for you, to despair of the promises of God, and to love boasting. My hope is that even though this is a brief introduction into the Desert Fathers and Mothers, at least you have a taste of why their simple spirituality is so valuable for us today. If you are drawn to read more of their sayings, don't be surprised if you are quickly offended by some of their seeming lower stage thinking. But stay with them in honesty and humbleness, and I'm sure they will teach you something of your own human nature and God's benevolence. in their irrelevance to our world, the desert fathers and mothers end up being amazingly relevant, precisely because their frame of reference is so utterly different than ours. We all need radically different frames to recognize our own limitations. Let us take this moment to practice silence, solitude, and simplicity. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Practice this week is titled The Sacred Heart. Abba Poman said, "Teach your mouth to say what is in your heart." Many of the desert fathers and mothers, as well as the Philokalia in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, have described prayer as bringing your thinking down into your heart. It always seemed like soft piety to me until someone taught me how to do it, and I learned the immense benefits of the prayer of the heart. I'm often puzzled by the continued return to heart imagery, such as Jesus pointing to his sacred heart and Mary pointing to her immaculate heart. I often wonder what people actually do with these images. Are they mere sentiment? Are they objects of worship or objects of transformation? You must return their gaze and invitation for a long time to get their transformative message and healing. Such images keep recurring only because they are speaking something important from the unconscious, maybe even something necessary for the soul's emergence. Love lives and thrives in the heart space. It has kept me from wanting to hurt people who have hurt me. It keeps me every day from obsessive, repetitive, and compulsive head games. It can make the difference between being happy and being miserable and negative. Could this be what we are really doing when we say we are praying for someone? Yes, we are holding them in our heart space. This is an almost physical sense, and you will see how calmly and quickly it works. Next time a resentment, negativity, or irritation comes into your mind, and you want to play it out or attach to it, move that thought or person literally into your heart space. Dualistic commentaries are lodged in your head, but in your heart, you can surround this negative thought with silence. There, it is surrounded with blood, which will often feel warm like coals. In this place, it is almost impossible to comment, judge, create storylines, or remain antagonistic. You are in a place that does not create or feed on contraries, but is the natural organ of life, embodiment, and love. Now the Sacred Heart and the Immaculate Heart have been transferred to you. They are pointing for you to join them there. The Sacred Heart is then your heart too. Thank you for being with me. May you encounter the Sacred Heart in silence, solitude, and simplicity.